You're listening to LGRadio.online. Welcome to In the Benny Green Archives.
Who's the most widely quoted Italian composer of all time? Some people might say it was Puccini for having written the tune of Avalon, even if he had to go into a court of law and fight a plagiarism action to prove it. But it's not Puccini I have in mind. Was it Verdi, after whom a form of spaghetti was named? Greater fame than that, there isn't. Maybe, or perhaps Leon Cavallo with Pagliacci. I'm sure old Leon would consider himself a contender. But my nominee is somebody different again. He certainly has a birth qualification, born in an Italian town called Fornia on January the 13th, 1885. By 1891, he'd had enough of all that and had come to America. At this point, I have to say that the information about him is a bit sketchy. One book even says he wasn't born in Fornia at all, but in Genoa. Anyway, they agreed that he arrived in America when he was six and settled down with his family in Albany, New York. The next thing we know, it's 1902, and he's working as a piano player in the local saloons, where he becomes known as Ragtime Jimmy. He appears to have been self-taught, but very popular with the locals. Then he moved to Chicago and played in the nightclubs owned by men whose noses had long ago begun to spread all over their faces. By 1910, he had reached New York, where he worked for the same type of music lovers. And then in 1912, a big hit. On this performance, there are two big hits, but our man only wrote one of them.
Gee, when we're paddling, meddling, ho. Hey, when we're paddling, meddling, ho. First we drift with the tide and pull for the shore. I hug her and kiss her and paddle some more. Then I keep paddling, paddling home.
You're doing it in the water.
Until I find a spot where we're alone. Hey, she never says no. So I kiss her and go. Paddling, paddling, sweet, sweet Madeline. Paddling, paddling home.
And then he'd row, row, row.
No outboard.
Way up the river he would row, row, row. A hug he'd give her, then he'd kiss her now and then. Or she would tell him when.
He'd poop around and poop around and kiss her then again. And then he'd row, row, row.
Go, go, go.
A little further he would row. Oh, how he'd row.
Why, he'd drop hold his oars. Yeah, take a few more on coat. Yes, yes.
When I'm paddling, paddling home.
Way up the river.
Hey, when I'm paddling, paddling home.
I'm giving
oh, sometimes we fall in, but it never gets dull. Cause Madeline yells,
pull around,
pull around again.
So
then he'd
paddling, paddling home.
A little further
until
he would roam.
Find a spot where
we
we're alone.
Yes, Mr. Mercer,
though the path was cold, I continue right on.
Then he'd roll and roll.
Sweet, sweet Madeline.
Job is hanging by a thread.
Johnny Mercer and Bobby Darin with their nautical anthology. Paddling Madeline Home was written by Harry Woods, and that doesn't concern us today. It's Row, Row, Row that introduces the theme of Italian music in the 20th century, because it was written by the immigrant from Fornia, or Genoa, James V. Monaco. I don't know what the V stands for, but I do hope that the birthplace is Fornia and not Genoa. Because Monaco died in Beverly Hills, and there's a kind of symmetry about arriving in Fornia and leaving from California. Row, Row, Row was featured in the Ziegfeld Follies of 1912 and had words by a man called William Jerome, who has a lot of credits we still remember, especially Chinatown, My Chinatown and Get Out and Get Under the Moon. I always remember Jerome as the lyricist who worked on the Broadway show with the daftest title of all time, Piff Paff Puff. Mercifully, we're not told what that one was about, but certainly it was a feather in Jimmy Monaco's bowler to have a successful partner like Jerome. After that, Monaco wrote himself an annual insurance policy with You Made Me Love You. But nothing much else we remember. After 1933, he seems to have stopped writing altogether. But then the whole thing takes an odd turn. In his early 50s, without a successful song for ages, he went out to the West Coast, underwent a professional marriage with the lyric writer Johnny Burke, and began writing songs for Bing Crosby. He did six scores for Crosby, and most of them had at least one hit. The first one, a 1938 concoction called Dr. Rhythm, had Crosby as a doctor and Louis Armstrong playing the role of Louis Armstrong. It's pretty painful all round and best forgotten, except for one song, which has enjoyed a modest but lasting recording life.
If you're wondering why I'm near you, even though I've been denied, I'm inclined to be a little on the sentimental side. I suppose I should forget you if I had an ounce of pride, but I guess I can't help being on the sentimental side. I should act gay, laugh it off and say farewell, say it's all good and well, well, but I'm not that way. I'm in hopes you'll think it over and perhaps be satisfied with the simple sort of person on the sentimental side.
Sentimental side from the film Dr. Rhythm, the song that Jimmy Monaco probably preferred to the rest of the picture. The trouble with discussing Monaco is that the bare facts read much too much like one of those dreadful storylines that Hollywood used to pump out about songwriters who start off with a bang, go into a decline, and then with everybody from central casting clustered round a deathbed, come up with another big hit. They did that with Stephen Foster, and they did it again with Paul Dresser. They probably used the same bed. And the same bewhiskered doctor looking down at his pocket watch, taking a patient's pulse and saying, either this man's dead or my watch has stopped. The fact that in both cases, Foster and Dresser, the story was true, doesn't excuse the films, which succeeded in making the truth just incredible. The same was true of Monaco. By 1945, at the age of 60, he had changed studios and moved over to 20th Century Fox, where he went to work on behalf of Betty Grable, June Haver and Assorted Blondes. In October 45, Monaco died of heart trouble in Hollywood, and I'm not sure if he hung on long enough in the deathbed scene to enjoy the kudos and the dollars of his last and one of his biggest hits, A Weepy, which was heavily featured in the picture The Dolly Sisters. The real-life Dolly Sisters, a couple of Hungarian brunettes, were magically transformed into a couple of American blondes by the script department, and most of the music was out of the catalogues of the past. But Monaco, working with Mack Gordon from Warsaw, created the only peace treaty between Italy and Poland that ever produced anything tangible.
I can't begin to tell you how much you mean to me. My world would end if ever we were through. I can't begin to tell you how happy I would be if I could speak my mind like others do. I make such pretty speeches whenever we're apart. Oh, but when you're near, the words I choose refuse to leave my heart. So take the sweetest phrases the world has ever known and make believe I said them all to you. I make such pretty speeches whenever we're apart. But when you're near, the words I choose refuse to leave my heart. So take the sweetest phrases the world has ever known and make believe I said them all to you.
I can't begin to tell you. The last hit of Jimmy Monaco, the Italian-born saloon bar pianist who had a funny knack of writing songs that people go on singing all their lives. I always associate him with a very incongruous distinction indeed. He was the last songwriter ever to imprint his work on the mind of the great cricketer, Dr. W.G. Grace. In 1914, within a year or so of death, the doctor was mobbed and serenaded by a bunch of adoring Nottingham factory girls. And the song they serenaded him with was Jimmy Monaco's You Made Me Love You, although I don't think you'll find that fact documented in Wisden's Cricketer's Almanac. That same song, You Made Me Love You, was the one which excited the wrath of George Bernard Shaw, who once attacked it in print as proof that the times were declining fast. Well, they were certainly declining on January the 16th, 1969, because that was the day they buried two quite distinct composers, even though they shared the same body. One was Vladimir Dukhelsky, an exiled white Russian of courtly origins who wrote a violin concerto, a cello concerto, several suites and string quartets. The other was Vernon Duke, who subsidized all this instrumental competition by writing some of the best show songs. As Vernon Duke, he was befriended by the Gershwin brothers, and I often wonder how they got along. The Gershwins were the children of parents who had to run away from Russia, thanks to the sort of treatment they were getting from the likes of Duke's white Russians. It doesn't seem to have soured their friendship, but Duke does have one thing in common with Jimmy Monaco, in that he has two birthplaces. One is Pskov, and the other is Parafamiento. But maybe Duke came from one and Dukhelsky from the other. Anyway, after a lot of false starts, Duke succeeded in 1932 with a show called Walk a Little Faster, which had the all-time hit April in Paris.
Have you ever been in London town in the merry month of May? There's another place that I know of that will take your breath away. Oh, April in Paris, chestnuts in blossom, holiday tables
under the trees. April in Paris, this is the feeling. No one can ever charm of spring, never met it face to face. I never knew my heart could sing, never missed a warm embrace till April in Paris. Whom can I run to? What have you done to my charm of spring, never met it face to face. I never knew my heart could sing, never missed a warm embrace till April in Paris. Whom can I run to? What have you done to
Well, I don't know how Vernon Duke managed to explain that kind of thing to Vladimir Dukhelsky, but no doubt it had something to do with paying the rent. Much, much better was the Ziegfeld Follies of 1934, and that's interesting in itself because Flo Ziegfeld died in 1932. In fact, the show was presented not by Ziegfeld, but by Ziegfeld's wife. As an act of wifely piety, Mrs. Ziegfeld, alias Billy Burke, produced the show and did everybody a great favour by giving a hearing to this song by Harburg and Duke.
What is there to say? And what is there to do? The dream I've been seeking has, practically speaking, come true. What is there to say? And how will I pull through? I knew in a moment contentment and home meant just you. You are so lovable, so livable. Your beauty is just unforgivable. You're made to marvel at, and words to that effect. So what is there to say? And what is there to do? My heart's in a deadlock. I'd even face wedlock with you. So livable.
Your beauty is just unforgivable. You're made to marvel at, and words to that effect. So what is there to say? And what is there to do? My heart's in a deadlock. I'd even face wedlock with you.
What is there to say? Now, I have no evidence that Duke cared very much about jazz, or if he was much interested in what jazz musicians did with the tunes, like the ones we just heard, or Autumn in New York, April in Paris, and several others. But whatever his attitude, he must have been almost as delighted as his bank manager to read that by pure fluke, one of his melodies had been picked up as a kind of anthem by the generation which was just coming to maturity as the last war started. By the 1960s, this song had grown into the symbol of the old days, when the future of the planet was still everlasting, there were no endangered species, and romance didn't have a bad name. The song came about through the death of George Gershwin, then busy on the score of the Ziegfeld Follies of 1936. There was this scene where Bob Hope and Eve Arden are standing about in the rain after a party. It's the small hours, taxis are scarce. It's very clear that he's crazy about her, equally clear that she would dearly love to be somewhere else. The words are a catalogue, recited first by the boy, later by the girl. But the real point is that there was no melody done when George Gershwin died. Vernon Duke stepped in and provided one.
I'm a glum one, it's explainable. I met someone unattainable. Life's a bore, the world is my oyster, no more. In all those papers where I led the news with my capers, now we'll spread the news. Superman turns out to be a flash in the pan. I've flown around the world in a plane. Settled a couple of revolutions in Spain. And with kings I've a la carte. Still I can't get started with you. On the golf course, I'm under par. Warner Brothers would love to make me a star. I got a house, I don't know what a house, it's a show place. Till I can't get no place with you. You are supreme, lyrics I write of you. Dream, dream day and night of you. Then I scheme just for the sight of you. But what good does it do in Cincinnati and even in Rangoon? I hum a few notes and all those chicks swoon. Still I'm so broken-hearted because I can't get started with you.
I Can't Get Started, the theme song of a whole generation, as it turned out, and in retrospect, the most potent melody that Vernon Duke ever wrote. I wonder if Dukelski ever did half as well. We know from the few examples we do have how rich a vein songwriting can be by post. That devastating attack on publishers, for instance, which George Gershwin sent to his own publisher when he wanted to publish a shortened version of one of the Gershwin songs. Or the note from Irving Berlin to Cole Porter after Porter had had a hit with Rosalie, a song he hated. The note said, "Never knock a song that sells half a million." Fragments like this can only whet our appetite. And I can vouch by personal experience that Johnny Mercer and Ira Gershwin were both outstanding correspondents. I once received a letter from Ira which he posted in a hurry and forgot to sign. So he sent me a note of apology which, as a way of atonement, he signed twice. One very interesting letter writer was Harry Ruby. And I bring him up because he was born January the 27th, 1895 in New York. Ruby is still remembered as a bit of a screwball, which is why he was so friendly with and wrote material for Groucho Marx. The letters of Ruby that I've been lucky enough to read are the ones he used to send to Johnny Mercer's dog while pretending to be his own dog. In these letters, Ruby's dog would tell Mercer's dog how mean Ruby was and asking if there was a chance of a vacancy at Mercer's house. I don't know what a psychiatrist would have made of it all, but really Ruby was only crazy like a fox, as they say. His partnership with Bert Kalmar produced hundreds of songs, a handful of which are still remembered, and one which I recall as one of the very first I learned to improvise on.
You smiled when we parted, it hurt me somehow. I thought there was nothing worthwhile. The tables are turning, and you're crying now, while I am just learning to smile. Who's sorry now? Who's sorry now? Whose heart is aching for breaking each bow? Who's sad and blue? Who's crying too? Just like I cried over you. Just like a friend, I try to warn you somehow. You had your way, and now you must pay. I'm glad that you're so sorry. Right to the end, you've been just like a friend. I tried to warn you somehow, but you had your way, and now you're gonna pay. I'm glad that you're so sorry now. Well, I'm glad that you're sorry now.
Edie Gourmet singing the Bert Kalmar Harry Ruby song that was first published very early on in their long partnership in 1923. There was at least one other big standard that they managed, and this one came about through the work that Ruby did for the comedians. As I said, Ruby himself was a slapstick character, and the people he enjoyed being with most were either baseball players or comics. Now, Ruby would much rather have been a baseball player, and it was only lack of talent which made him settle for songwriting second best. Anyway, a man who writes songs for the Marx Brothers, Bobby Clark, George Jessel on Broadway is bound to end up in Hollywood, and that's what happened to Kalmar and Ruby in 1930. They went to work for the RKO Studios, whose executives even then were beavering away so tirelessly towards bankruptcy. And they fell in with a fiasco called Check and Double Check, remembered today only for two reasons. First, it marked the screen debut of Duke Ellington, and second, it had a big song by Kalmar and Ruby. The picture starred those household names, Freeman F. Cosden and Charles F. Correll. Only those weren't the names in question. Cosden and Correll very wisely decided to work under an assumed name, Amos and Andy. Well, Check and Double Check sunk without trace. Kalmar and Ruby did all right out of it with their big song. In the painfully scripted biopic about Kalmar and Ruby, starring Fred Astaire and Red Skelton, it was suggested shamelessly that this next song gave the team trouble and hung around for years before the words came. In fact, those words came early, quickly, and easily. And according to some cynics, the title is not a reference to the phrase, I love you, but to New York Yankees.
Three little words. Oh, what I'd give for that wonderful phrase. To hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my days. And what I feel in my heart, they tell sincerely. No other words can tell it I have so clearly. Three little words, eight little letters, which simply mean I love you. What I feel in my heart, they tell sincerely. No other words can tell it I have so clearly. Three little words, eight little letters, which simply mean I love. Simply mean I love you.
Three little words, which shares with Who's Sorry Now the status of being Kalmar and Ruby's best known song. Generally, the pair of them preferred being facetious. And when you glance down the list of their credits, you can see how it affected their songwriting. Among their published works, I see Keep Your Undershirt On, Knock Knees, She Was an Acrobat's Daughter, Don't Tell Your Mudder Nothing, and lots of others which will probably never be featured at Covent Garden, and not unless you're thinking of a fruit market. Ruby died back in 1974, but his career petered out long before that with some indifferent stuff for forgotten 20th century musicals. Except that in 1946, working with Rube Bloom on a picture called Wake Up and Dream, he came up with Give Me the Simple Life. But there's no question at all that Ruby was only really happy when he was watching baseball or writing clever and calculated nonsense. Harry Ruby, the one who not only posed as his own dog, but as his own Jewish dog. This week, we ought to be celebrating the anniversary of one of the great songwriters, one who started out with one of those incongruous jobs that songwriters so often seem to choose before they get around to the serious business of the day. Mr. Babcock, who arrived on January the 26th, 1913, got a job when he was 16 as an announcer on a local radio station. Well, after about a year, all that he was announcing were his own compositions, which is one way of doing it, I suppose. When he was 20, he went to New York. When he was 27, he went to Hollywood, and the rest is simply a matter of a vast catalogue of great songs. Each year when I mention Mr. Babcock, I'm at a loss to know what to choose. I play this next recording simply because I'd never played it before. The song comes from a musical picture that I caught up with, or rather, it caught up with me, in 1946. Which means, I suppose, that the songs were written in 45. It was all about four girls who have this brilliant vocal quartet and no brains. Now, this is unusual in the world of song, where what you usually have is four girls who have this dreadful vocal quartet and no brains. In the picture, which was hopefully called And the Angels Sing, the girls included Dorothy L'Amour and Betty Hutton. And what happens is that they get taken for a ride by a crooked bandleader, played by Fred McMurray. I mildly enjoyed the film at the time, partly for the presence of Miss L'Amour, partly because all my life I've enjoyed the spectacle of people impersonating crooked bandleaders, but mainly for this really beautiful Babcock ballad.
Hide your heart from sight, lock your dreams at night. It could happen to you. Don't count stars or you might stumble. Someone drops a sigh and down you tumble. Keep an eye on spring. Run when church bells ring. It could happen to you. All I did was wonder how your arms would be, and it happened to me. Your dreams at night. It could happen to you. Look out, stars, or you might stumble. Someone drops a sigh and down. To me.
It Could Happen to You, which of course reveals that our Mr. Babcock didn't remain Mr. Babcock for long, even though his great fan Frank Sinatra often refers to him in public to this day by that name. We know him as James Van Heusen, one of the great masters of the popular song and one of the most prolific. In the same year that he wrote the songs for And the Angels Sing, Van Heusen and his partner Johnny Burke had an unusual chore: to write a song for a picture which was about as far removed from a musical as you could get. This was the screen biography of a man called John L. Sullivan, the first modern heavyweight champion of the world. Well, that's what they say. I don't want to spill over into sport on two, but as Sullivan won his title by fighting with bare knuckles, I've always doubted his claim to be a Queensbury Rules champion. Anyway, in 1945, they made a picture called The Great John L, with an enormous lump of muscle called Greg McClure in the leading role. But the producer of this picture was Bing Crosby, and Crosby's great friends at the time were Burke and Van Heusen, so up comes this excellent song while the opening titles were rolling. It was only a few minutes after this that John L. Sullivan was rolling, he being the kind of athlete who used to train religiously every day by lifting crates of beer, but only after he'd emptied them.
Just say that I'm a friend of yours, and if they see us together. I'll brush the dreams from my eyes. I'll tell my heart it mustn't sing the song of when. Just say that I'm a friend of yours, that you happen to meet again.
Just Say That I'm a Friend of Yours, except on the Japanese record albums where it's referred to as Just Say That You're a Friend of Yours, from the 1945 picture about John L. Sullivan. Just before we leave Sporting Corner, I might as well add that after he retired from boxing, John L. saw the error of his ways and became a very famous temperance lecturer. This presented certain difficulties, like managing to climb up onto the platform without falling over. Van Heusen's partnership with Johnny Burke was eventually superseded by the one with Sammy Kahn that was virtually a service for providing Frank Sinatra with good songs, and one which produced a great deal that nobody's forgotten since. Least of all Sammy Kahn, who could always manage to tell you one more time how things were. The most remarkable story is the one connected with the great song coming up, not written for Sinatra, but for Fred Astaire. But the plan foundered, and the song ended up not being sung, but being talked into a mirror by the star of a picture called Papa's Delicate Condition. Now, the star of that picture was Jackie Gleason. Now, Mr. Gleason, gifted though he is in his own way, is not the kind of performer to take a great song and make it sound great. At this point, enter Frank Sinatra, who likes the song so much that he includes it in his nightclub act before he's learned it. According to Kahn, it sounded wonderful even with the wrong lyrics. Anyway, thanks greatly to Sinatra, the song was recognised for what it was, won an Oscar, and has become well known as the five-syllable lyric by the kid from the one-syllable neighborhood.
Call me irresponsible. Call me unreliable. Throw in undependable too. Do my foolish alibis bore you? Well, I'm not too clever. I just adore you. Call me unpredictable. Tell me I'm impractical. Rainbows I'm inclined to pursue call me irresponsible. Yes, I'm unreliable, but it's undeniably true. I'm irresponsibly mad for.
Frank Sinatra making yet another Karl Van Houten song all his own. And that's it. See you same time next week.
You've been listening to In the Benny Green Archives here on lgradio.online. Please do visit the website to find out when the next episode is on, along with all our other shows. This is lgradio.online. Thanks for listening.